All right, so I will go very fast on the review of things that you've seen in other courses. It will be very short, all right, just to introduce the necessary formalism and notation that we will be using. And a little bit on the, you know, a bit of an informational insight, perhaps, on some of the things. So that's why I'll project that. It will be very short, the projection, and then we'll go back to board, okay? So I want to introduce formalism of how to characterize quantum states, of course, and for that, let me first introduce the postulate of quantum mechanics. Now, the number of postulates that you will see around will vary depending on who you're talking to, I guess. My opinion is that it's better to keep them at minimum as possible. So we will have here four postulates if you want, three here, and then maybe one or half, or one and a half, depending on how you look at it, when we look at measurements. We haven't gotten there yet. Perhaps just to tell you a note on this, some texts in quantum mechanics, right, like Griffiths and others, also postulate things like Schrödinger equation, right, and the particular form of Schrödinger equation, when you have non-relativistic quantum mechanics. I don't do that, and the reason is that Schrödinger equation doesn't need to be postulated. You can derive it out of another postulate, which is not here, which is that the principle of covariance, that is, the laws of physics should be the same in non-inertial reference frames. So if your group of symmetries for changes of reference frame is the Galilei group, then you obtain Schrödinger equation as a consequence. You can derive it from that. If anybody's interested in seeing that, I can point you to notes and texts that do that. But indeed, you don't need to postulate Schrödinger equation. It's much better to postulate that the laws of physics don't depend on your reference frame, right? So to me, that's way more elegant. So for me, these three postulates are all there is, plus excluding measurements, of course. Make sense? All right, so postulate one is about characterizing states of dynamical systems. And what we say is that, well, we associate each physical state with a unique state operator, and that operator is called the density operator, okay? We notate it as rho. And it has to satisfy three properties. It has to be positive semi-definite, it has to be normalized to one, and it has to be self-adjoint. Make sense? Of course, there are reasons for each of these three. Maybe you can remind me if you remember. Why do we want it to be positive? Anybody knows that? Yeah. Go ahead.
My understanding was that it relates to postulate three.
Oops. So, your understanding is what, sorry?
Is that it relates to postulate three?
It's not quite, I would say. Yeah, go ahead.
Probability.
That's right. We want to interpret, so, and we'll talk about the difference between the postulate three and that. We want to interpret this as a probability distribution over states, and we will mention that in a second, right, over known states of the system. So, of course, we need it to be positive semi-definite. It has to be normalized to one. Again, it's the same logic. We want the probability distribution to be a probability distribution, so the probability of everything happening should be one, or anything happening, sorry, should be one. And it is self-adjoint. Anybody knows why? Well, I mean, again, being self-adjoint guarantees that you have real eigenvalues, and that's what you want, okay? Again, we want to have a probability distribution. Make sense, everybody? Yeah.
It's not a two-way condition, right? Real eigenvalues and not be selfish.
That's correct, but that guarantees it, though. So any self-adjoint operator will have real eigenvalues, okay? If you're self-adjoint, your eigenvalues are real. All right, so postulate two. So then we represent states with operators in a Hilbert space. Make sense? All right. Postulate two. Physical observers are represented. Physical observers are dynamical variables, all right? So functions of your phase space quadratures, functions of your generalized position and momenta, if you want, they're going to be represented by self-adjoint operators. And not only that, it also says that the results of a measurement of an observable that produces a definite value will always be in the spectrum of the operator that represents it. Make sense? You have an observable represented by a self-adjoint operator, and if you carry out an experiment that gives you one result where you're measuring that observable, well, the result better be in the spectrum of the self-adjoint operator. Make sense? All right, again, many reasons for that, but I can give you one. Self-adjoint operator, again, guarantees that the eigenvalues are real, observable quantities are real, dynamical functions that are observable are real, so that guarantees it. Make sense? And postulate three, which I call here Born's rule, is the probabilistic interpretation of measurements in quantum mechanics, which is a probabilistic nature, rather. No, I don't want to use interpretation here, which tells you, okay, what is the probability of measuring an outcome alpha I when measuring an observable represented by a self-adjoint operator A, alpha I is in the spectrum of A, and then, well, we say that that is this expression here, right? The projector on the eigenspace associated with that observable, with that result, applied to a density matrix, trace of that. Make sense, everybody? All right, so those are my three postulates. Now, the density matrix, and I'll be, again, I don't submit you to torture of slides of text for very long, so bear with me. The density matrix, right, one of the things is that, well, literally, by construction of these postulates, the density matrix can be understood as a probability distribution over states that are well known, okay? States that I can represent as a state vector in a Hilbert space. So indeed, I can understand this row as a distribution of distinguishable states, if you want orthogonal states, right? And those pi here, in this case, are the eigenvalues of the density matrix. Makes sense? And then, of course, this is a convex combination. This means that, okay, the sum of all the coefficients is 1, all the coefficients are larger than 0. That implies that the trace of rho is 1, which is what we wanted. And indeed, this is certainly interpretable as a probability distribution over known states. I have a density operator, and that tells me, well, yeah, I can understand it as with probability 1/2 I have this, with probability 1/2 I have that, for example. Make sense, everybody? All right. All right, so something that's important to note, okay, above all for information and foundational purposes, is that the interpretation of rho as a probability distribution over states is not unique. You know that, okay? You've seen that assuming quantum mechanics, but it's important to emphasize it here. You already know why, even 15, which is the spectral decomposition of the density operator, even 15, you can already tell that there's some ambiguity, no? Because if you have degeneracy, that, you know, if your eigenvalues are degenerate, right? You have that in mind, if your eigenvalues are degenerate and the dimension of the eigenspace associated with that eigenvalue is larger than 1, then you have certain freedom to choose, a total freedom to choose the eigenvalues, the eigenprojectors, the individual eigenprojectors over each of the dimensions, if you want, of that degenerate eigenspace, right? And that already tells you that at the very least, within the degenerate sectors, I can understand this as different probability distributions of different states, no? But it's even worse, quote unquote, or better, depending how you look at it, than that, right? Let's look at that state. Imagine that I have a state like 17 in this example, right? This is clearly, so I have, you know, two states. Think that you are making up your row, right, out of extracting states from a machine that gives you one of two things, right? It gives you the state 0, right? You have a quantum system that is two-dimensional, so two possible known states that are orthogonal. And then you say, well, I have a machine that gives me 25% of the time gives me the state 0. And a machine the machine gives me the state 1 with probability 3/4, 75% of the time. Make sense? So it gives me something. I'm not measuring it. I'm just looking at it. And then I want to describe what's the state of the thing that is given to me. Well, I don't know. You see, in the case of when we look at quantum mechanics, right, you have two sources of uncertainty about the outcome that you would get out of a measurement. One is, well, if I have a quantum superposition, certainly the outcome of a measurement is probabilistic. I don't know it a priori, right? But there's also classical uncertainty that can be there. It's like, well, you can have uncertainty about the outcomes even if you know the state, but you can also not know the state. Like in the case of the black ball and the white ball in a bag. I struck one and I don't know the state. I know that my best description for the state is 50% probability black, 50% probability white, and that's nothing, there's nothing quantum about it. This is just a classical probability distribution reflecting your ignorance about the state you have. Agreed? In this case, you have ignorance about the state you have. And the ignorance comes because, well, you don't know which one the machine gave you, right? And because of that, your best description for the state that you have is, well, with 25% probability, I know I have 0. With 75% probability, I know I have 1. Make sense? Nice. But then you can say, all right, let me talk about two different states, plus and minus here that I have. So plus, if, for example, 0, you think of it as being an eigenstate of sigma z, right? And 1, now it's sigma z, those would be the eigenstate of sigma x. Nice. So I have plus and minus. And then that row that initially was this distribution here can be written as very stupid manipulation, adding and subtracting the same thing. You end up with this expression. Rho 17 is actually equal to rho in 20. And this is interesting, right? Because rho in 20 tells me that I can express this as a, if you want, convex combination of these states. Now, these states are not orthogonal, you can tell. But you can definitely, this is a probability distribution over states as well, non-orthogonal states, but it is. For example, I can have a machine very different from the first one that half of the time, or sorry, 25% of the time gives me the state plus. 25% of the time gives me the state minus, and 50% of the time gives me the state 1. And I'm extracting a state from that without knowing which one I've gotten. I only know the probabilities. The density operator reflecting that state of ignorance is this one, which is the same as that one. So indeed, the density matrix forgets about you prepare that state. It's just reflecting your state of information. Your state of information in case 17 is the same as in case 20, even though they came from different preparations. Make sense, everybody? So that is the non-uniqueness of the interpretation of rho as a probability distribution. And in fact, there's infinitely many ways, right? That's what I want to say here. Of interpreting this, right, as a probability distribution. There are fewer where the states are fully distinguishable, like orthogonal, of course, there's only one basis, let me put it like that. There's the eigenbasis of rho, where you diagonalize rho. As long as that's not degenerate, well, there's one objective way of doing that with orthogonal states. But if it's degenerate, one of the eigenvalues is degenerate, not even in that case. You have ambiguity about how you got to that state, if you want. Makes sense? So rho is telling you rho needs to be understood as the reflection, or at least in our course, we will understand rho as the reflection of a state of information. Make sense? State of information about the system. And saying in an agnostic way, I'm not gonna get, if you force me to, I'm not gonna get into discussion about epistemic versus ontic interpretation of the quantum state, because that's outside of this course in a way. It's a foundation question. I'll be happy to engage with you after class and give you my opinions and my arguments for those opinions. But in principle, in this course, we're going to definitely understand density operators as reflecting your state of knowledge about the system. Make sense? By the way, of course, I'm not going to get into that. There's two ways of thinking of rows, right? Because there's a statistical, mechanical, like, or maybe you're describing the ensemble of all possible things that are coming. But very often, we'll do single shot experiments in quantum information. So that ensemble interpretation is not as useful for us, if you want. It's much better to talk about, well, even if I have an individual system, rho is reflecting my state of information, the best I know about the system. Make sense? Any questions? But you've seen this before, so it's not surprising that there aren't many. Now, of course, very basic things, right? You fall, and this will be in the notes, but this is just telling you, yeah, indeed, because of, you know, this is justifying the postulate one, why we picked it to be the way it is. You can tell, of course, that the expectation of observables, right, which is sum over diagonal elements of the operator, what is this? What am I doing here? It's missing a row. Yeah, it's missing a PI, and I'm sorry. I'm sorry about that. A row, it's missing a row here. Sorry about that, it's a typo we will correct. So the density matrix, right, I mean, you can actually compute the expectation value and you get indeed the expectation value of an observable O would be the convex combination of the expectation value on each of the eigenstates of rho with the probability PI, right? That makes sense. Anyway. Now finally, or not finally, I guess, almost finally, for the projected part, let me distinguish between pure and non-pure states, right? Pure states are those that can be represented as state vectors. you have a pure state, you know exactly what state you have. Make sense? Your state of ignorance is zero. I know exactly what state I have. Make sense? So pure states are those that the trace of rho square is one. And indeed, you can tell that if the trace of rho square is one, even though it's not written here, this implies that the state is just a projector of rank one. Make sense? That's the only way it can be a trace of rho square equal one, meaning that it's describable just with a state vector. Means that I know exactly the state. It's ketsai, that'll be my state. Or if you want a probability distribution with probability one of being that state. Make sense? And now let me introduce the purity here before talking about something a bit heavier. The purity of the state, right, as I call it there, is I call it the trace of rho square. The purity of the state is bounded from above and below, right? The minimum amount is 1 over d, right? 1 over d would correspond to the maximally mixed state, and by that I mean a state that I know nothing about. A state that I know nothing about would be a homogeneous probability distribution over all possible states, agreed? And that's a multiple of the identity. And it has to be normalized to 1, the trace, so 1 over d identity. You see, if you have the maximally mixed state, you have zero information about your state, which means that I actually have no idea what state I have. And of course, it's the identity. The identity is invariant at the changes of bases, right? So no matter what your reference states are, you still have homogeneous. In all bases, you have an homogeneous distribution. Make sense? You know nothing about this state. Make sense, everybody? This is the least pure that something can be. And purity is, of course, equal to 1 when you have a pure state. When the state is a state vector, I know everything. The opposite of a homogeneous distribution, and a maximally skewed distribution, where you know with probability 1 that you have something. Make sense? Here's a little, so this is something I won't get much into, but this is to convince you that indeed this is a measure of how mixed a state is. So what we do here, just to tell you as well, we have a row, and this row is a one parametric family of states. When the parameter is 1, you have a pure state, and you know exactly what state you have. When the parameter is 0, you actually have the maximally mixed state, full ignorance. Make sense? And what this tells you is that, well, indeed, this thing is a monotonically increasing function of A. The longer A is, the more pure you are, the more purity you have. And also, it's very easy to see the bounds with this expression as well. Make sense? Anyway, not necessarily what we need. And then the last thing that I will project is this definition before we move, the von Neumann entropy. Now the von Neumann, of course, we're talking about probability distributions over states because of our ignorance, and we just discussed in the first lecture that a very reasonable way to quantify ignorance is the Shannon entropy. You have a probability distribution, and you ask me, what is the ignorance I have about the probability distribution? The Shannon entropy will tell me the ignorance that I have when I have a random variable and I have the probability distribution about the random variable. Make sense? So the von Neumann entropy is defined as the probability, as the Shannon entropy associated with the probability distribution over distinguishable pure states that the density operator rho represents. The orthogonal one. Maybe we should include the word orthogonal in there. Make sense, everybody? So this certainly is telling you the amount of ignorance that you have when you have a row. I don't know the state. How much you don't know the state? Well, that amount in bits. If you have a log 2, maybe we should write a log 2 here as well, because we're going to be using log 2 for everything. If you have a log 2, that's the number of bits of ignorance that you have about your actual state. Make sense? Or about your about the state of your physical system. Make sense? Good. Now, what is interesting about this, right, is that this entropy, this von Neumann entropy, is not defined, or von Neumann did not introduce it as a thermodynamic entropy. It's an informational entropy, the same thing as the Shannon entropy is. Agreed? So a question that may come to mind is whether this is related to thermodynamics or not. Is there any connection between the amount of ignorance that you have about a state and anything thermodynamical or not? And we'll stop the projection here and we'll switch to the board. Any questions? Yeah.
log of a density matrix, how do you compute it?
So the density matrix is, so if you have an analytical function, use the spectral theorem. So maybe there's a green one here. I'll do it with the green one. So f of some self-adjoint operator h, right? And this is not very difficult to prove, assuming that f is an analytical function, is the sum of f of the eigenvalues of h. So, right? Let's call this hi. All right. And this is the function of the eigenvalues and then the projector over the eigenspace. To prove that is not difficult, what you have to do is take a Taylor expansion, define the function of an operator as this Taylor expansion, right? And then use the fact that projectors square to themselves. So you factor out all the projectors and you're left with a Taylor series of the function. So in the end, you see what I'm doing is that exact thing here. and also, of course, for that, the function is, you need to be within the radius of convergence of the series to do that, but you are, because rho is positive semi-definite, so you're fine. Make sense? And non-degenerate, it has to be trace one, so the eigenvalues cannot be all zero. Make sense? Good, good, good. All right, so we stop the projection. And stop the projection. And the light will turn on too, or maybe somebody can click. Yeah, thank you. So again, this is things that all of you or most of you have seen, right? Obviously. Right, so let's discuss a little bit the thermodynamic value, if any, of the von Neumann entropy. And then maybe first I'll try to convince you that there's a relationship and we will see it. And then we will discuss if the von Neumann entropy is always thermodynamic entropy. Make sense? All right, so let's revisit the notion of Gibbs thermality. So anybody remembers here what Gibbs did back in the day? To establish what we call thermality. I mean, maybe I should refresh the zeroth principle of thermodynamics, no? The zeroth principle of thermodynamics tells you that states of equilibrium can be characterized with one parameter. Make sense? And that parameter we call temperature, or empirical temperature, rather. Make sense? So states of equilibrium are one parametric families. And the zeroth principle is one of the most powerful, the zeroth law of thermodynamics is one of the most powerful ones. And the reason is that also talks about something magical that you need to postulate into existence. Remember, the laws of thermodynamics come from experimental observation. Huh? They are not derived. They are, if you want, postulates. We've done many things in the world. We've observed the world a lot. And we've come to the conclusion that these laws are always universally satisfied. They're extremely powerful. The laws of thermodynamics apply to every system that you can think of, as you probably know, like all the way from black holes to ourselves, in a way. But there's something magical about thermodynamics. There are two magical things in thermodynamics. The fact that no matter how complex a system it is, if you cannot see the microdynamics, it's actually possible to still describe the interaction of the big system that I don't know the micro constituents with only a handful of parameters. This is magic. This is telling you all the individuality is lost the moment you have a system that is big enough. And this is wild. This allows us to do many things, very complex many things. And this is kind of the revolution you see, a bit parallel to what we have right now. At the end of the 19th century, at the middle of the 19th century, towards that, physicists were saying, well, we have two frameworks here that work really well in the realm of application. We have mechanics and we have thermodynamics. And mechanics and thermodynamics are very widely different. However, people build engines where you have thermal systems for which you use thermodynamics and you do work, mechanical work. And they were like, wow, but they're widely different. And it was like people like, again, this guy afterwards, but Boltzmann, Maxwell, and others. I mean, classes. I mean, I can talk about many people. Maxwell is one of my favorite physicists, so I always mention him. It was fundamental for this, that realized, actually, we can link the two. The two frameworks that have nothing to do with each other and we would love to give a unified description of it, we can derive thermodynamics from the mechanics or the microscopic constituents of the system, and that was the birth of statistical mechanics. And the parallel today is that, well, people are trying to do something like that all the time with quantum theory and our theories of gravity, right? Two frameworks that are difficult to talk about together. Very similar from the point of view of what happened and the scientific moment, only that in thermodynamics it took maybe like 20 years, but also they had Maxwell, right? So we don't have Maxwell anymore. So Gibbs in particular, so the zero principle also talks about the magic of something else, which is thermal contact. Thermal contact, what a thing. You see, the interaction Hamiltonian between this wall and my hand is complicated, agreed? I mean, in fact, it's not enough. I mean, I need this wall, my hand, and the universe. And then I can give you an interaction Hamiltonian, right? There's losses to the environment and all. It's very complicated. Well, no matter. I don't care. I don't care about the specifics. We have observed that if I have a chunk of thing in equilibrium and another chunk of thing in equilibrium, even in non-equilibrium, I will put them in contact. And they will eventually reach a state of equilibrium with the same empirical temperature, both with the same characterization of parameter. How weird is that? Independent of the interaction, the principle of thermal contact is pure magic. But we see, right? You can get a chunk of ice, and you can get another thing inside the ice, and it will reach thermal equilibrium. Agreed? Eventually. Makes sense? That's weird. Like, thermal contact is weird. Keep in mind, we're talking open questions already, huh? In quantum thermodynamics and in open quantum systems. Thermalization is a complicated process, and it's not fully understood as of yet, okay? Luckily, we have the zero principle. That's nice. So Gibbs was trying to describe state of equilibrium, and then Gibbs realized of the following. Okay, so we have also the second law of thermodynamics. Second law is what breaks the symmetry between the direction of time, okay? That's the reason why we don't need the full Poincaré group. We don't need the full Lorentz group to do relativity, among other things. It's okay to just pick SO plus 1,3, right? Because we know, well, I mean, future-directed vectors are special. I can distinguish future-directed time-like vectors just because of second law of thermodynamics. And then we say, okay, fine. So we can call something future time flow because of that. Otherwise, you know, the differential geometric description of relativity does not distinguish two directions. So if you have time-orientable Lorentzian manifold, which one is the future? Well, I don't know. Well, you do, the one that satisfies the second law. Make sense? So Gibbs realizes of the following. Well, the second law of thermodynamics tells me that under spontaneous processes, entropy has to increase. Agreed? Then Gibbs says also, all right. But equilibration, the process of reaching equilibrium, is spontaneous in the sense that I leave a chunk of something in contact with the chunk of something, I don't touch it. Make sense? So it's a bunch of spontaneous processes that start happening that eventually lead to equilibrium. Agreed? So because all those processes are spontaneous, entropy will be increasing. Agreed? And then eventually they will reach equilibrium. When they reach equilibrium, entropy will stop increasing because they don't change anymore and all that it did is just increase until there. Well, if it's been increasing, then the state of equilibrium should correspond to a maximum, at the very least a local maximum of entropy. Make sense? Because, you know, through spontaneous processes, which is what leads to equilibration, all that happens is increases of entropy. So eventually, you hit equilibrium, you're at a maximum of entropy. Make sense? All right, so this is the notion of Gibbs thermality is precisely saying the state of equilibrium corresponds to a maximum of thermodynamic entropy. And by thermodynamic entropy, I mean the entropy as described to us by the second law, as introduced to us by the second law. The fact that, you know, heat flows from hot to cold, the fact that engines cannot be operating between two thermal sources, cannot be arbitrarily efficient, all those things, the introduction of entropy, that's the thermodynamic entropy, the one that the second law introduces. So that's the notion of Gibbs thermality. Make sense? Cool. So what we're going to check in this lecture is, okay, what happens if I take as the entropy of a quantum system the von Neumann entropy, and the von Neumann entropy, of course, is an informational entropy, huh? But what I'm going to do is, okay, I'm going to, for a second, assume maybe that the informational entropy of my state is going to play a role of thermodynamic entropy. I'm going to see what happens when I maximize informational entropy at some constraint, at constant energy. So I'm going to get a system that is isolated from its environment, completely isolated from its environment. So energy should be constant. Make sense? All right, of course, if you have a quantum system, so maximization of von Neumann entropy at quote-unquote constant energy. I'm not going to get into discussions of different symbols and what they mean and an open versus closed system and so on, so we're going to just keep it simple because it's an information, a quantum information course. So what do I mean by constant energy? So by that I mean, of course, this is a quantum system. So there is a Hamiltonian H for my system. It's a closed system, so I don't need to care about interactions with an environment here. Okay? So this is, if you want, a system that is left to its own devices. And I'm going to let it equilibrate. So what I say, so constant energy constraint means that the expectation of H is constant. Okay, that's what I mean by constant energy here. Make sense? All right, so what we want, maximize entropy, or rather extremalize entropy, what we want is to get, okay, I want to have, this is notation for variations with respect to the state, okay? I want to have, of course, let me put it like that. I write here the von Neumann entropy, and I say, well, just equate the derivatives with respect to the state of the von Neumann entropy to zero. But of course, you cannot just do it like that. You need to put a couple of constraints. Number one, I mean, I don't want this to be the zero operator or something, because if it's the zero operator, maybe that will give me the zero directly, entropy zero, if you want. I don't want that. I want to constrain this to only the, or if I allow the trace to go to infinity, then the entropy can grow to infinity if I want. The dimension of the state, you know? So I don't want to, the trace of the state, sorry. I don't want to allow for that. I want to consider only optimization over physical states. So there has to be a constraint. Trace one constraint. That is the trace of rho is equal to one. So I need to impose two constraints here. One is that the energy is constant, and the other one is that the trace is equal to one. How do I do that in an optimization problem? Well, Lagrange multipliers. That's how you impose constraint to an optimization problem. Make sense? All right, so you have minus beta trace rho h minus e minus mu trace of rho minus 1. There you go. An optimization problem with two Lagrange multipliers. The first one imposes the constraint that the energy has to be constant, or the expectation value, rather, of energy has to be constant. The second one imposes that the trace of rho has to be 1. And I call the mu and beta the two Lagrange multipliers. Make sense? Everybody happy so far? Questions? Yeah.
I missed the beta part. What did that condition correspond to?
This. So expectation value of H is the same as trace rho H. Make sense? And that's what I'm fixing to be E, constant. Make sense, everybody? Good, good. So maybe I'll just go up here. What I'm setting up here is a problem, let's keep it in mind, of maximization of the the Shannon entropy of a state row. So what is, I want to find the state row that maximizes the Shannon entropy at constant energy. Make sense? Good, good. So let me write the ingredients in here. So this is minus trace. Oop. Also, this board is not as nice as the other one. Minus trace of rho log rho. Okay. Which is the same as, so let me just write it here. I would say, I'll do that. Maybe I'll write it here for part of. So I'm going to assume that rho, right, has the following spectral decomposition. Okay, this is, let it be the spectral decomposition of rho. So it's the sum of the eigenvalues of rho times the eigenprojectors over the eigenspace associated to that eigenvalue. And in general, each, the rank of pi is going to be ni. So the degeneracy of, this is a self-adjoint operator, right? So there's not going to be any problems related with deficiency in the geometric multiplicity. So we know that this thing diagonalizes always. That's all that I mean. You can always diagonalize it in the reals in particular. So this is the degeneracy of each eigenvalue. So each eigenvalue appears ni times. Eigenvalue rho I appears ni times. Make sense? Which is the same as the rank of the eigenprojector, the dimension of the eigenspace associated with that eigenvalue. All good? So that means I can write this with as the sum of ni rho I log rho I. All right. All right. Now, of course, I also have that the trace of rho is equal to some I and I rho I. And finally, I have as well that H expectation value is the sum of I and I rho I EI. And this is C. And this is 1. Now, what did I do here? How did I get that? In order to take that step, what I'm assuming here is that the Hamiltonian and the density operator diagonalize in the same basis. See, the intermediate steps here, if I were to do them, I would have rho times h, and then I want to compute the trace of that. So let me sum over the diagonal states over the, I didn't say both, over the eigenvectors, if you want, of rho, right, to do that trace. And well, in order to get the eigenvalue EI, so let's say that A, by the way, let me just write it here too. H is going to be equal to EI, and then EI. If I have that H is this, then it's clear that I would get that H acting on the eigenstate of H would give me the eigenvalue EI. So there's an assumption in here we can discuss, which is that H and rho share the same eigenbasis, diagonalizing the same basis. Make sense? Is that a reasonable assumption, or is it an extra thing that I require? What do you think? Okay, let me write it here. For this to be true, the assumption is make sense? That the rho and h commute, therefore the diagonalizing the same basis. Now, my question, maybe for the class, if you want, is if this is an extra assumption that is reasonable, or what is it? Why am I? It feels limiting, no? Why the Hamiltonian is a different one? Are you all only solving for that kind of Hamiltonian? Why? Anybody? Yeah?
I think it makes sense that they share eigenbasis because we only know that we know that the the P must be some, like, the outer product of some pure state, and then that, we know, I don't know how to explain.
Okay, so all that you said is correct. Let me give a point. It may not be the reason why, but it's correct. What I mean is that la puntualization is not necessarily the product, if you want, the tensor product, the tensor product of a Ken and a Bra. Because that's the point. If it's degenerate, it would be a sum of tensor products. So the rank is not always one. This PI would be something like that, which is what you're saying, only if the rank is one. If the rank is not one, it would be a sum of these things with, you know, like different one and two and three. You know what I mean? So it's not always that. It's a combination of those in general. No, the reason is that what I'm looking for, you want to say?
I think that if we are at the equilibrium, so the state is not evolving.
Precisely. So what we try, thank you. What we're trying to find here is a state of equilibrium, right? If your state does not commute with the Hamiltonian, it's not going to be equilibrium. It's going to evolve. So one of the necessary conditions for equilibrium is stationarity. So you cannot change under time evolution to get equilibrium. That's necessary, not sufficient to be thermal, by the way. But it's a necessary condition. So of course, this is implied by the fact that we're looking for the equilibrium state. So this is a stationarity condition. Make sense? So we can write that because we know that when this is solved, when we find those states, they're going to be equilibrium states, hopefully. So assumption, stationarity. It is an assumption, but it makes sense. Okay? All right. Good. So having all that, I can now properly rephrase this problem. Okay? Let me tell you. So if the variation of rho that I'm looking for is how the eigenvalues change, because I already know the eigenprojectors. Keep in mind, the Hamiltonian is fixed for this system. So the Hamiltonian tells you the eigenprojectors. For a fixed Hamiltonian, all the freedom that you have is change the eigenvalues of rho. Make sense? The eigenvalues would change and give me the distribution of eigenvalues. We already know that rho is going to be diagonal in the energy eigenbases. Give me what are the eigenvalues that maximize the informational entropy at constant energy. That's what we're after. Make sense? So now we can translate this abstract partial rho to a concrete, definite mathematical problem. All right. Let's do it here. So what I have is partial rho I of this whole thing. Keep an eye for typos. Keep in mind, these notes is the first time that we run them as they are. So when you get the notes, if you find typos and so on, don't doubt yourselves. Just email us, okay? Because there might be signs appearing and disappearing, and again, arithmetics, not our specialty, and neither Irini or me. So please keep an eye out and let us know if you see any typos. Rho I, log rho I. Missing a minus. You see, for example, this is a typo. Nobody told me this. I lost the minus sign somewhere, and this is also a typo in the notes, because this thing should have the minus in here as well. I see that Bindija is writing it out. Thank you. All right. Log rho I minus beta sum n I e I rho I minus e minus mu sum I n I rho I minus 1. Now this is a set of linear equations coupled to each other. We can solve for that now. Make sense? So all that I did is write this equation, right, in terms of the expressions, in terms of the eigenvalues and eigenprojectors of rho, well, eigenvalues in this case, because the eigenvalues and degeneracy, right? Knowing that the only thing that can change are the eigenvalues of rho. Yeah. Make sense? All right, let's go ahead and solve this. So this is the same as, let's take the derivatives, and we're left with minus log rho I minus 1 minus beta EI minus mu equals 0. The n's cancel, of course, and divide by the ni's, both sides. Those are the set of equations that we have. Make sense? As many as different eigenvalues of rho. Okay. Now, what we can do, this equation, we can multiply both sides by pi. We multiply both sides by the eigenprojectors of rho. And also, and sum them all. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to multiply this by pi, this by pi, this by pi, this also, but it's 0, OK? So it's the 0 operator. And then I sum all the equations. If I do that, I obtain the following. This becomes the log of rho. It's just a spectral theorem expression for the log of rho. Right? This becomes the identity, obviously, sum over all the eigenprojectors. This thing becomes beta H, spectral decomposition of the Hamiltonian. Remember, diagonalizes in the same basis as rho, so has the same eigenprojectors. And we have also mu identity. Again, same thing, spectral decomposition. And this is equal to the zero operator. Make sense, everybody? Well, the nice thing is that there's an equation on the operator rho that extremalizes that informational entropy. That's that von Neumann entropy, which is a Shannon entropy. So I can just isolate rho on one side of the equation. And what I get is that rho, it's equal to the exponential of minus mu plus 1 times identity exponential of minus beta h. Maybe some of you are seeing already that the choice of beta for the multiplier was not random. Okay, so far so good? I'm just solving rho there. Yeah?
Where did your degeneracy go?
Yeah. This had an ni, this has an ni, this has an ni, this has an ni, divide by it, both sides. Make sense? Everything has an ni here.
Then
I forgot to write
that. Equations should have ni's if we are adding them, multiplying by pi and everything
else. No, but I'm multiplying by. Sorry, I want the identity there. If I'm missing projectors, I have a hard time. Make sense? Oh, no, that's not right, my bad. You PIs, all of them, they're dimension, my bad. No, the sum of PI is the identity. So I don't think anything is missing, no? I'm not sure what the problem is. So this cancels all the NIs. There's nothing missing. The rank of the projectors are not 1. Everything's correct. The sum of all the eigenprojectors is the identity. That would be the spectral decomposition of the operator. Make sense? Of the identity, sorry. So the same thing. If you have an eigenbasis, so if this is the eigenbasis, and I sum it, right, this is the identity. This is exactly the same as that. Agreed? Only that some of the p's will have 2 of those. The number of summands here is different as here. Is everybody happy with that or not? Questions, comments? The sum of all eigenprojectors of an operator is the identity. Agreed? A self-adjoint operator. That's all that I'm using here. OK, cool. So we have this rho, and this is the rho that extremalizes the von Neumann entropy. So let me just find out. All that we need to find out now is the value of beta and the value of mu. Agreed? Mu is easy to find because it just imposed the trace 1 condition. Agreed. So what we have is that, let me put it here. Trace of rho equals 1 means that mu plus 1, which has to be equal, maybe let me more handily call this, if you want, 1 over z of beta e to the minus beta h. So what I did here is call mu plus 1, defining as the log of z of beta. OK, it's a notational thing. I define mu plus 1 equals log z of beta. OK, so this is literally 1 over z of beta. Agree, everybody? OK. The imposition of trace 1 means that z of beta has to be equal to the trace of exponential of minus beta h. That probably rings a bell in everybody's head. This has a name. Well, I haven't told you what beta is, but when I tell you what beta is, this has a name. Do you remember how you call it? What do you call this thing? What's that? Oh, beta. No, I'm not talking about beta. I'm talking about z.
Partition function.
The partition function, indeed. Right, so we haven't found beta yet. Question, yeah?
Ask a question. So in terms of units, here we say that somehow the thermodynamical entropy is equivalent to this von Neumann entropy. And I'm a bit confused about these units.
We haven't said anything yet.
We haven't said anything. So.
No. So we will see at the end. We'll see at the end.
I will
address the units, I promise. Sure. But we haven't said anything about, you know, all that I'm saying is that what happens if I maximize the informational entropy? Do I get something that looks like an equilibrium state in thermodynamics or not? That's what I'm trying to address. I haven't said anything. Yeah? The von Neumann entropy as I define it doesn't have a KBT because I'm an information person. A KB, sorry. I'm an information person. Question.
So when I'm a bit confused by this thing. Like when we started out with those forms of the density operator and the Hamiltonian, if we restrict that to like the ith subspace,
the what?
The ith subspace or the jth subspace.
What do you mean restrict?
Just look at rho I pi.
Okay.
Then the operators are proportional. Like I mean, is that an assumption or?
No, they're not proportional. They're a function of each other. And it's a function that doesn't change. In fact, you can tell here what function it is. It's the exponential map, right? So the degeneracy in one is the degeneracy in the other as well. That comes already. You can prove that already by the fact that they commute. Huh? OK? No, because it's a really good question. Anyway, so what I'm going to do now is find beta. That's what we need to find. And we found, if you want, mu by the trace constraint. To find beta, we need the other constraint, the energy constraint. So the trace of rho h equals c implies that e is 1 over z of beta trace of h exponential of minus beta h, which is the same as minus partial beta log of z beta and this thing is again this thing is e. So nice. Imposing that this is equal to a constant, what is telling me, the constraint that is telling me is that the partial derivative with respect to beta of this partition function logarithm is e. All right. So we can go, maybe you remember that from your StatMech as well. All right. But this is a particular kind of statistics, if you want, how you derive the energy from a partition function in statistical mechanics. Anyway, so let me just write the state finally. So I know that rho beta, it's equal to 1 over z beta, sum over I, exponential of minus beta, EI. So I wrote it, so of course, maybe I should have written, so rho is this thing. I actually put the beta in here because this is a one parametric family, even though beta is related to the energy. Energy is one of our freedoms. Total energy is one of our freedoms, expectations. So let me just parameterize this beta by rho. And what this is telling me is that beta is a probability distribution with probability exponential minus beta EI of being in the eigenstates of energy EI. Make sense? And then, of course, normalize. Well, that is interesting because then you can look at thermodynamics and say, all right, now forget. What I did here is maximizing the information entropy. Somebody else in the 19th century looked at what kind of statistical distribution I should get if I maximize a thermodynamical entropy. And they found that the statistics distribution are the Maxwell-Boltzmann family of statistic distribution. What is that statistic distribution? Well, it's precisely that the population of every energy level, or the probability of being an energy level, if you interpret the ensemble as making one experiment, would be actually the exponential of minus something, energy of that level. So if we identify this with the state of thermodynamic equilibrium, we know that beta has to be kBT. Make sense? We get into the units problem. So what we have here is that, well, if I maximize the informational entropy, I actually obtain the weights of the population, the probability of populating an energy level EI is actually given by a Maxwell-Boltzmann factor, by a Boltzmann factor. So I'm obtaining exactly the same thing that I was obtaining when I was doing the optimization that I get for maximizing thermodynamical entropy. And that means that this beta that has to have units of inverse energy, of course, I already know that, dimensional analysis, this beta would actually, the maximization of the von Neumann entropy equates exactly to the maximization of thermodynamic entropy if beta is kBT. Make sense? So if you want empirical observation with thermodynamics, or if you want if this is a state of thermodynamical equilibrium, beta has to be kBT.
1 over kBT.
1 over. Oh, I'm just stupid, and that's what happens with me. Thank you. I said the dimensions right, though. Make sense? So it turns out that the von Neumann entropy is acting like a thermodynamic entropy to all effects. I said, well, it doesn't have the right unit. Sure. Let's use dimensional analysis, I'll give it the right units. Multiply by the dimensionful constants that you need, kB, in order to give it the right units. Make sense? But look at this, this is kind of big. Huh? Let me just, before caveats, yeah, it's good for the last 5 minutes to do caveats. Before doing that, what have we done here? We have proven that maximizing the von Neumann entropy, which is a Shannon entropy of the state, what we've done here is found the state of maximal ignorance at constant energy. That's what we've done. Maximal ignorance at constant energy. And what we found is that the state that maximizes ignorance at constant energy happens to be a Gibbs state. Gibbs state, what does a Gibbs state? Well, it maximizes the thermodynamic entropy at constant energy. So what we're proving here, or showing here, or indicating here, I don't know if we call it a proof, but at least a very, very strong intuition, that the von Neumann entropy, the informational entropy, is thermodynamic. Makes sense? So maybe thermodynamic entropy and informational entropy are not two different things, but are actually the same. Maybe von Neumann was up to something when he told Shannon, why don't you call it an entropy? Shannon never thought originally to call that the thing that he developed an entropy, because for him it's like, well, it's ignorance, and so how is that entropy? But this, comparing with the Gibbs entropy, tells you exactly, well, yes, maximizing informational entropy, maximizing ignorance, gives you thermality, or gives thermality. So they are connected. Make sense? Ignorance is thermodynamical. Information is thermodynamical. Make sense? Everybody? Are you convinced? Okay, let me tell you caveats, right? The von Neumann entropy will not always be a thermodynamic entropy. There's a problem that already happens with the Gibbs entropy in classical thermodynamic systems. Think of the problem of a free expansion, the free expansion of a gas. So I have this room, I have a wall in the middle, I have a gas at some pressure here, I have vacuum on the other side. Now I break the wall, okay? The gas expands freely to the other side. Does not work whatsoever. Agreed? And then now the gas occupies the whole room. Entropy has increased. The number of microstates compatible with the distribution in the whole room is much bigger than the number of microstates compatible with the distribution in half of the room. However, the process is symplectic theory mechanics, but let's talk quantum. It's a unitary process, right? This thing is just evolution. It's free evolution, if you want. The gas, imagine the gas doesn't even self-interact. It just expands, moves, right? It's unitary evolution. Unitary evolution cannot change the von Neumann entropy. Agreed? Therefore, here we have an increase of thermodynamic entropy that is not an increase of von Neumann entropy. Make sense? So the von Neumann entropy, same as the Gibbs entropy. Yeah? This is not a problem of quantum. This is a problem of the particular entropy that you get when you do that. It's not capturing the full notion of thermodynamic entropy. There's something called observational entropies, right, that generalize the Gibbs entropy and generalize, of course, the von Neumann entropy in the quantum case that account for that. And you see how important it is, because clearly, when you break the wall, you are losing information. You have some information about the state. The state is, well, they're distributed here. The probabilities of finding them here is that and that. When you break the wall, you've lost information. How? Not by changing the state in a way that the state has leaked information to the outside. No. That's one way of losing information. The other way of losing information is I made my phase space bigger. I'm more ignorant. If you see, if my room is small, it's very unlikely to get lost. If I make my room 10 times bigger, if it becomes a palace suddenly, I'm more likely to not know where I am. Those are two ways in which you can lose information. One is, oh, because the state that encodes some information leaks it to the outside. But the other is, well, now the possible states that it can have has increased. So I lost information. And I don't know which one it can be. A renormalization of the probability distribution of finding one particular state, if you want. Those are two ways in which you can lose information. And von Neumann entropy accounts only for the first. Look at the fact that the other one is less related to the system itself, more related to the phase space that's available to the system. Make sense, everybody? Caveat number one. We will not have to worry too much about that, because in all the cases that we're going to consider, the von Neumann entropy will be a thermodynamic entropy. That is important to say. The other caveat is that this state, for this state to exist, it requires this thing to exist. Nobody has talked here about the fact whether this state actually exists. This trace actually exists. So the question, in other words, the exponential of minus beta Hamiltonian, is that a trace class operator or not? So, in general, for any finite dimensional system, this trace exists. All finite dimensional self-adjoint operators are trace class. But if you have a continuous spectrum, if you're in the continuum, right, this is not guaranteed to exist. The exponential of minus beta Hamiltonian is not guaranteed to be trace class. Now, in some cases it is, like you have a harmonic oscillator, yeah, this thing is trace class. But in many other cases, it doesn't exist. In fact, in even the simplest of quantum field theories in the continuum, this thing is not trace class. So the notion of thermality that is the most general, the one that you can apply to QFT, is not that. Because you cannot really do this calculation if this thing is not a trace class operator. Agreed? So the notion of thermality given by Gibbs is not enough. It's not the most general. It's not the most fundamental, if you want. The generalization of this is called KMS thermality, Kubo-Martin-Swinger thermality. And I do have lectures when I used to teach relativistic quantum information here. That is important, actually. And I have in the notes, there will be a link to the video if you are interested in anything like that, to the video where that is dealt with. But let me give you some intuition that is going to sound like rigorously done in that, because you need complex analysis and you need to be careful with things, okay, to do it properly. And this is done in the video I sent you. Let me give you just a hand wavy thing that is kind of cool. I promise not to give you things that you cannot prove here, but for that I will. This is kind of cool. The notion, so if you look at this thing, the thermal state, right? Huh? The thermal state looks a lot like, excuse me for this. I apologize in advance. It looks a lot like this. No? Agreed? The difference is that you have a parameter, real parameter beta, and here you have, if you want, an imaginary parameter IT. Make sense? Let me just write it like that. OK. So if T becomes I beta, what happens? That U becomes the thermal state, kind of. See what I mean? But this is ridiculous. It is. But let's look at it for a second. The actually true condition of thermality is related to this observation. The actually true condition for a state to be thermal, there's a condition on how the correlations of two observables, of any two observables, any two bounded observables of the system, how the correlations behave in imaginary time, when you evolve them in imaginary time. And that is actually, believe it or not, that is the core of thermality. The KMS condition is a condition on the analytical continuation of the correlation functions between observables. And the condition is that they are both holomorphic on a strip and antiperiodic. And that condition is one of the tenets that you do to define thermality in QFT. As you know, I mean, I'm not going to get, obviously, this is beyond the scope of the course. If you're interested, there will be a link to a lecture on that exact thing. But you see, the notion of imaginary time is related to this notion of Gibbs thermality, of thermality. In fact, you can prove that the KMS condition that is imposed on imaginary time, right, on correlations on imaginary time, is an if and only if with Gibbs when this thing is trace class. So it generalizes Gibbs. It's Gibbs when Gibbs exists, and it's something else when it's not. And again, if you're interested in that stuff, I will link something. But that's pretty much it. So what we've done today, just to summarize, is to show that informational entropy is kind of a thermodynamic entropy, at least in these kind of scenarios where the phase space is fixed, the volume of phase space is fixed. Make sense? Any questions? Because our next step is going to be now talk about entanglement armed with that knowledge. Any questions? Is that clear? I don't know. What I want to know if everything is more or less clear. All right. This course shouldn't be I'm struggling to understand the notions kind of course. So if there's something you don't understand, come to me, 100%. Or to anybody in the course. Right? We have Irini. All right. Then I'll see you on Monday.